Beginning with the wife and children.
Put on.
Nana. By name only.
Dharmana.
By their behavior.
Vrika Shigala.
Tigers and jackals.
Ava.
Certainly.
Anichchata.
Of one who does not desire to spend his wealth.
Api, certainly. Anichchata.
We skipped a line.
Kadayasya. Being too miserly. Kutumbina. Who is surrounded by family members. Uranakavat. Like a lamb. Sanrakshamanam. Although protected. Mishita. Of one who is observing. Api. Even. Hananti. They forcibly take away. My dear King, family members in this material world go under the names of wife and children, but actually they behave like tigers and jackals. A herdsman tried to protect his sheep to the best of his ability, but the tigers and foxes take them away by force. Similarly, although a miserly man wants to guard his money very carefully, his family members take away all of his assets forcibly, even though he is very vigilant. Purport. One Hindi poet has sung. Who knows Hindi? Can you read it out loud?
Hindi Dakini Rati Bandini Palak.
What do you think? Everyone heard him?
During the daytime, the wife is compared to a witch. And at night, she's compared to a tigress. Her only business is sucking the blood of her husband, both day and night. During the day, there are household expenditures, and the money earned by the husband at the cost of his blood is taken away. At night, due to sex pleasure, the husband discharges blood in the form of semen. In this way, he is bled by his wife both day and night. Yet he is so crazy that he very carefully maintains her. Similarly, the children are also like tigers, jackals, and foxes. As tigers, jackals, and foxes take away lambs, despite the herdsman's vigilant protection, children take away the father's money, although the father supervises the money himself. Thus, family members may be called wives and children, but actually, they are plunderers. Translation again. My dear King, family members in this material world go under the names of wife and children, but actually they behave like tigers and jackals. A herdsman tries to protect his sheep to the best of his ability, but the tigers and foxes take them away by force. Similarly, although a miserly man wants to guard his money very carefully, his family members take away all his assets forcibly, even though he is very vigilant. Om Jnana Jimadandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Sivasati Gaur Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. This chapter is giving you a deeper a more specific understanding of the previous chapter. So these chapters, the forest of enjoyment, teach you the realities of material life. Life without Krishna in the center. Allegory is a very effective method of teaching when you don't want the person to become put off too much by your explaining things directly. Instead of doing that, you present a figurative example, an allegory. Let me tell you a story. As you recall, this is what is done in the fourth canto with the story of King Paranjana. Rather than tell someone directly, you're wasting your life, instead you present a story about someone else who is wasting their life. Often when I am speaking in one country, I will talk about life in another country so that people will not be, they'll not become too put off. And then I always add, after talking about life in the other country, for example, if I'm in Australia, I will speak about life in the USA or the UK. And then I will add at the end, of course we know that Australia is different. Or of course we know that India is different. And then people, the point is how to get people to swallow the medicine. And sometimes you have to be very strategic, and that is what is being done here. An example is given, a very vivid example, so that you'll remember the forest of material enjoyment. You enter the forest looking for pleasure, looking for treasure. You go deep into the forest. You get lost, but you don't care at first because you trust your faculties, you trust your senses, and you're very infatuated, you're very much absorbed in your own sense of independence. And then when it's too late, you realize, I'm deep in the forest, I don't know what I'm doing. Who will protect me? And then you realize all around you are wild animals. There's danger at every step. So this description, this allegory, the forest of material enjoyment, imprints itself on your mind, and you can remember it. The descriptions are very vivid, just like in this verse. I'm sure you won't forget. Family members in the material world go under the names of wife and children, but actually they behave like tigers and jackals. This is material family life. We hope to have Krishna in the center of the families. And that way, all attachments can be converted into efforts to satisfy Krishna. This is how bhakti is so ingenious. Instead of letting everything remain attached on the bodily platform, the bhakti system says, all right, you have family, have a legitimate family, and keep Krishna's service in the center. And then gradually you realize that the real attachment is for Krishna. First, you become attached to helping the family members be Krishna conscious. And gradually, by doing that, by helping them to be Krishna conscious, you realize that everyone's real attachment is actually for Krishna. So this is the system of Yukta Vairagya, using everything for Krishna's pleasure. Everything means everything. Husband, wife, children, grandparents, possessions. As Bhaktivinoda Thakur sings, Manasa Deha Geha Yog Kichumor, Arpilin Tuya Pare Nan Kishore. Oh, Nan Kishore, whatever I have, mind, body, home, possessions, it's all yours. So this is real civilized life. What you're hearing about in this verse is when Krishna's service is not properly prioritized. Then you get another reality because you're being managed by the illusory energy. So indeed, these descriptions are completely accurate for those who have forgotten Krishna. Forgetting Krishna means forgetting Krishna's service. Forgetting that Krishna is the number one priority. Often when I am speaking to devotees, they bring me problems which are basically caused by prioritization. What is number one in their life? The problems are caused by letting something else take the number one position. Something else other than their bhakti. As the fourth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam says, two of the four Kumaras are speaking. They say there is no greater mistake you can make in life than to establish something as your number one priority other than your own self-realization. There's no greater mistake in life. So this is the material world, and it's always throwing impediments in the way. That's why you're attacked by happiness and distress as they come and go. But in bhakti, you learn how to use everything in Krishna's service, even so-called happiness and so-called distress. You use the distress to come closer to Krishna. And you use the temporary happiness to come closer to Krishna. You're not attached to the happiness or distress in of themselves. You utilize them, just like you have implements or tools or machines. You use them. So similarly, the devotee uses happiness and distress for how to become more attached to Krishna. This is how perfect and complete bhakti is. So as for the very graphic descriptions in the verse and purport, what can I say? These are the realities of material existence. The Bhagavatam is presenting things, it is said sometimes, from the male point of view. But actually, only Krishna is the male. Everyone else is female. Sometimes contemporary persons ask, why always the wife is being talked about? What about the husband? Or as is said these days, the partner. Has that come to India yet? The partner? Yes? The younger generation? Yeah, partner. No more spouse. That implies slavery. But partner, like two business persons joining in an enterprise. Equal. And any moment they can decide to separate, to end the business relationship. So partner. So the Bhagavatam presumes human civilization in which men have strength in terms of sense control, mental discipline, and they have integrity and some spiritual standard. But you can't assume that these days. And therefore, the ladies get upset. Like, why are we the only ones being criticized? When at this present day and age of Kali Yuga, look at the men. They're so weak. They can't control their senses. They're not strong in their determination. They have a very difficult time focusing. And so the ladies become upset. Why are we the ones that are always being talked about? Look at the men. More and more it's becoming like this, even in India. So you have to understand that the Bhagavatam is presuming some civilization, which is not there, rapidly disappearing today. In other words, things are degrading so much that it's hard to find someone who actually knows what is the standard of human civilization, whether male or female, whether from India or not. Just like I always point out when we have retreats with our young Indian students and professionals in their 20s and 30s, I point out that when we first started doing these retreats at New Nandagram for the students and young professionals in the Melbourne area, at that time, 20 years ago, it was very rare, never or very rare, to find couples living together who are not married. Now, it's just, what's the big deal? It's like that for so many. So you might wonder, the older generation might wonder, well, what do the parents back in India think? Oh, well, their children who are in Australia just tell them, we're saving rent money by living together. And so the parents think, oh, saving rent money, very good. That is the main thing. And they tell their parents, each one of us has a separate room, and that way we save the rent money. And the parents don't really have a clue what's going on. So 20 years ago, this practically would never happen. Now, it's just normal. So the men think this is a very good business. This is very nice. The ladies give of themselves with no commitment, no standards. So the men, they like this. But the men don't realize that by playing this game, they become very weak. Their character is destroyed. Their backbone is destroyed. They lose their determination. They have no integrity and character. So in this way, the men think they're having a good time. As the saying goes that Prabhupada would quote, why should there be marriage commitment? Or not now anyway, after some time. Because if there's milk available easily everywhere, who needs to keep a cow? If all the ladies freely give of themselves with no stipulation, no commitment, no formal arrangement, then let it be. And the men can just go from woman to woman and think that's the way it is. So this is a great tragedy for everyone. So then the ladies allow the men to plunder freely. But when it's time for marriage, the ladies say, well, where are the good men? Well, guess what? You help to degrade them, and then you want to marry. And then where are the men of character? Well, why did you facilitate their neshes? Why did you facilitate their Kali Yuga behavior? So both are to blame. But as Kali Yuga marches on, you'll see that more and more the degradation increases. At the same time, because of Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan mission, some persons will become more and more Krishna conscious, while others are becoming more and more degraded. Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan mission is like an umbrella. If there's a huge downpour, but you're under an umbrella, you can remain reasonably dry. So there's a huge downpour of degradation in Kali Yuga, but for those who take shelter of Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda, they're protected, even though the deluge, the downpour, is going on. So these descriptions in the verses of the chapter, The Forest of Material Enjoyment, they're letting you know what life is like. They're reminding you
of what life is like without Krishna in the center. And then you have all these horrible happenings in which during the daytime the wife is compared to a witch, and at night she's compared to a tigress. And then what about the men? Where are the real men? That's the question so many ladies of today ask. Where are the real men? Where are the Arjunas? Where are the Prichit Maharajas? Just as Arjuna explains in the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita, when he's giving his reasons why he doesn't want to fight the battle of Kurukshetra. And his reasons are very scientific. They're the best of reasons for not doing what Krishna wants. Strishu Dastasu Varshneya Jayate Varna Sangha. Krishna, if we fight this battle, we'll destroy civilization. Because so many men warriors will die. They'll leave their wives without a husband, the children without a father, the whole social system will break down, and therefore, we'll go to hell, Krishna. He's telling Krishna, we'll go to hell. I've heard that those who destroy the family tradition reside in hell. So his reasons are sociologically correct. And indeed, when you read Bhagavatam, first canto, about the scenario after the battle of Kurukshetra, you find Yudhisthira Maharaj lamenting that all the things Arjuna said are happening. And it's all because of me. Yudhisthira Maharaj is blaming himself. I wanted to be king, and therefore, look at all the havoc, all the destruction, all the deaths, just to make me king. I'll never get over this. I'll never be free from the sinful reactions. Just like a wine-stained pot can never be used, no matter how many times you wash that wine-stained pot. Similarly, there's nothing I can do to become free from all these sinful reactions. Just as Arjuna pointed out. What to do? Of course, this is not Yudhisthira's fault. But being a great soul, he's taking it in that way. And Krishna arranged that not even Krishna himself could pacify Yudhisthira Maharaj. This is Krishna's arrangement. You would think, is there something Krishna can't do? But he's arranging to glorify his devotee Bhishmadev. So they all went to Bhishmadev, where Bhishmadev is on the bed of arrows, and they hear Bhishmadev explain to Yudhisthira Maharaj the duties of a chief executive and why Yudhisthira Maharaj should take up the post without lamentation. So remember, Arjuna's reasons were correct. Krishna, if we fight this war, will destroy the fabric, the social fabric of society. But why did Krishna not listen? In fact, what did Krishna say? Asochana basochastam pragyavadam shabhasase. You're speaking big words. They sound very sociological, very learned, but you don't know what you're talking about. You're not talking with intelligence, which, as you know, is Krishna's indirect way of saying you're a fool. Arjuna gave the best reasons, but Krishna rejected them because Krishna's vision was even bigger than the sociological reasons that Arjuna gave. And this is difficult for many persons to understand. Even in India today, you'll meet persons who say, oh, Krishna allowed a war to happen. Krishna pushed a war. He's a warmonger. They're thinking in terms of the way war is waged in recent human history. Basically, when you talk about war in recent human history, you mean killing civilians. Whereas the Battle of Kurukshetra was fought in a remote place. Even today, Kurukshetra is still remote, yes? You can just understand what it was like thousands of years ago. So no civilians were involved. Today, war means
kill the civilians, especially the women and children. Terrorize the population so that the government will surrender. Just like before the atomic bombs were dropped on two cities in Japan. There were firebombs dropped on Tokyo. Hundreds of bombers dropped napalm on a section of Tokyo particularly picked out because it was full of wooden houses packed together. And there were no parks in the area because when there are parks, they stop the firestorm from spreading because there are no buildings on the parkland. So the place was chosen, the section of Tokyo was chosen which would get maximum incineration, maximum firestorm. So, in the space of 6 hours in one night, 100,000 people burned to death. Civilians. So, Battle of Kukshetra is not like that. It involves the professional military class. Arjuna, Karna, Duryodhana. These types, these real Kshatriyas, would rather die than miss a battle. I've got to be there. There's a battle. I can't miss this opportunity. That's why, what does Krishna tell Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita? Happy are those Kshatriyas who get a opportunity for a genuine battle. If they win, they enjoy the earth. If they die, they go to the heavenly planets. So this is a difficult mentality for us to understand. Wait a minute, who wants to fight? Who wants a war? But you have to meet a real Kshatriya. There are a few that exist these days and understand. They love it. They wouldn't miss a battle for anything. Of course, they don't know anything about going to the heavenly planets. But still, they have that kind of material propensity in which they want to protect. And they are not afraid of battle. In fact, they relish a battle. I know one example in which there was a false alarm given to the electronic warning system for the U.S. Air Force. And so the false alarm told them that the Soviet Union had launched an attack. And so the strategic bombers with the nuclear weapons took off. And the system at that time was that the strategic bombers with the nuclear bombs heading over the North Pole to Russia, they would pause on top of the North Pole and wait for corroboration, wait for confirmation. This is the real thing. So many bombers took off loaded with nuclear weapons, and they got to the North Pole, and one pilot describes, "We were ready. And then we got the message, turn back, false alarm." Oh, it was the saddest day in my life. How horrible. We were all ready for action. They could have died and they'd carry nuclear bombs that would kill millions of people. But it's the saddest day in my life. The mission was aborted. We had to turn back and go to the Air Force Base. Couldn't proceed any further. You think, what kind of mentality is this? But this is a Kali Yuga Kshatriya mentality. Never mind that I'll die and so many others will die. It's a battle. Very difficult to understand. Just like in Vedic times, it would be very difficult for persons to understand how millions, billions of people could work for someone else. In the Vedic system, a brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya never works for anyone. But now, as you know, you either become a wage slave or you starve. Unless you have your own enterprise, your own business, you have to work for someone else. Yes, it's IT, accounting, engineering. Still, you work for someone else. But in the Vedic age, that would be considered horrible. Only Shudras would work for someone else. Only Shudras need a master. So it's a different time now than the classic Vedic age. And similarly, for family life, it's different than thousands of years ago. Although there is no doubt, and you should have no doubt, that the Vedic system of sociological arrangements is far superior than anything existing today. But we just can't artificially force persons into the sociological concepts of the Vedic age, because you're dealing with psychology and physiology that's so different, so far from the standard. Just like the caste system. Everyone knows the concoction of Brahmana by birth, when actually it's guna and karma, as Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita. You're classified in your occupation, your varna, according to your guna, your qualities of behavior, and karma, according to your activities. So people sometimes wonder, well, why is it that the family lineage in the Vedic system is stressed so much? Just like Krishna referring to Arjuna, O scion of Bharata, O Kaunteya, always referring to family line. Because the families during the Vedic times were very expert at preserving the high qualification. They performed garbhadan samskara. They knew how to bring into the world children of good quality. So even though there's no such thing as a brahmana by birth or kshatriya by birth, back in the Vedic age, it was quite normal that a brahmana mother and father would have a brahmana child, or a kshatriya mother and father would have a kshatriya child. It was quite common because the parents knew how to preserve, shall we say, the family heritage. They were very careful about that. So people have a hard time understanding this these days. They think it's automatic, the Vedic system. A son of a brahmana means he's a brahmana automatically. Whereas no. Simply, in Vedic times, if the parents were truly brahmanas by quality and behavior and activity, most likely they would have a brahmana child. Perhaps you could say that just as if two parents today are doctors, it doesn't mean automatically that their child is going to be a doctor. It does mean the child has a good chance to be a doctor, that's all, but it's not guaranteed. So we are living in times which are completely topsy-turvy. Wherever you go in the world, east, west, north, south. How many of you were alive in 1977? Anyone? Brihadvan, you weren't alive in 1977? That was the first time I went to India. When I was 26 years old, I went to Vrindavan and Mayapur, Mumbai. What a difference compared to now, right? So different. Were you there then, 1977? Do you remember? You know, you were just a little kid, right? So different. Everything was 100 times more inconvenient than now. Just to make a phone call was an impossibility. You had to book a phone call hours in advance. And You always have to yell, hello, hello. Huh? Anji, huh? Oh, it was crazy. And then for airlines arrangements, you had to go in to the airline's office, go to Indian Airlines or Air India. Nothing could be done over the phone. They wouldn't even, you try to call them, you never get through. You have to go there personally. That means you have to go from Vrindavan to Delhi just to make a booking or change a booking. Everything was so difficult. But there was still some culture left. Now things are changing so rapidly. One of our former members of Melbourne community, his children were becoming 10 and 12. They were born here. And so the wife was starting to wonder, I don't want these boys, my boys, to grow up in Australia where there's so much degradation. So even though the husband had a very good job, corporate engineer, and they had a home, they had purchased a home, everything set up, he was very... Both of them were very active in the congregation here. But the wife said, we have to go back to India. We have to go back to Delhi and give the children a fair chance to grow up without any contamination that's so present these days. And so the husband was very reluctant. Oh, my job is perfect. We own our own home. We're active in the community of devotees. We go back to Delhi, who knows what's going to happen. We have to start from scratch, building everything up. We have nothing. But when the wife wants something, very difficult to resist. The campaign just goes on and on and on and on, right? So the man realizes, if I want peace at home, there's only one way. I have to surrender. So he gave in, and they sold the house, they sold all their possessions, and he quit his job, and then they moved back to Delhi for the pure life for their children. And what happened after 3 months in Delhi? The wife comes to him and says, oh, I can't believe how hellish it is here. Oh, it's very degraded. I look out on my street at 11 o'clock at night and there are teenage boys and girls talking in the dark. Oh my gosh, everything has changed. Sometimes they're hugging and what is this? Let's go back to Melbourne. What do you think the husband's reaction was? Oh my God. He's like, it's unbelievable. I know, because I had to hear some of this. He was in a state of shock. We sold everything. We gave up our house. I gave up my top job. And now we've only been here 3 months, and she wants to go back because India has changed so much. She didn't realize it. So yes, change is happening so rapidly everywhere in the world. So people need to hear this forest of material enjoyment. They need to hear this in Bhagavatam. And therefore, you have such strong, colorful analogies, examples. We need strong medicine, because without Krishna completely in the center, we'll be like this. All these things that you hear about, will apply to us. How vicious persons can be, even one's own family members. I've told the story before, you may not remember, about a trip. This happened in Ukraine. One devotee in a smaller city in Ukraine where there's no big temple inherited a flat. And in Ukraine or Russia, to inherit a flat means, oh, you have made it. You have your own flat inherited from your parents. Never mind how big or small it is. Oh, life is so easy, much easier. So he inherited a flat from his father. And he was so happy because he wanted to use the flat for Nam Hut meetings because there was no center in that city. Very glorious. But his own mother and his own uncle, the mother's brother, hated that he has the flat. And his own mother and uncle started a vicious campaign against him, attacking their own son just because of the flat. And so they tried all kinds of legal maneuvers. And in Ukraine, legal maneuvers, much more than India, means whoever pays the most gets justice. So this battle is going on. Who can outspend the other in terms of bribing to get the decision from the judge? And so then one day, the mother calls him up and said, your uncle and I have had some realizations. It's horrible how we're fighting like this. Let us make peace. I want you to come over and have lunch, and we'll discuss how to end all this horrible battling. And if it happens that you want the flat, so be it. Just come and let us reconcile. Let us harmonize as a family. So he was, of course, very happy to hear this. And so he went for lunch to his mother's place. She had everything. She had contacted his friends and got some tips about Ayurveda because she knew her son liked Ayurveda cooking. And she even had the copper water pot. And so he sat down for lunch, and then within 3 minutes, he was on the floor screaming and yelling with his mother and uncle standing over him saying, "Die! Now die! Die!" They had poisoned the food. His own mother. There he is on the floor, just in agony, and your own mother is standing over you saying, "Die! Die! Die!" The person from whose womb you came. Miraculously, he didn't die. He was taken to the hospital, and some other he survived. The doctors say it's a miracle. And after that, the mother went completely crazy. She just lost her mind after doing such a horrible thing. So you hear about these things and you understand the forest of enjoyments examples are for real. I hear these kind of stories not simply in Ukraine or Australia, also in India. But there, of course, it's put under the rug more. But sometimes in quiet, confidential moments, persons in Mumbai, Delhi, they tell me these things that have happened. So we need to hear this, because otherwise without hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, we'll become attached to material life and not attached enough to Krishna. So this is the mercy of Srimad Bhagavatam. Everything is said in order to detach you from matter and attach you to Krishna. All right, any questions? Yes.
While we talk a lot about relationships, when we are trying to do some sort of outreach to say relatives, wide family, and that sort of thing, obviously we cannot use any of this kind of, what do you say, very harsh kind of truths that are mentioned in Srimad Bhagavatam. So how do we actually share some of these kind of realizations with them, and also, like, you know, the theme of Kali, we can see that generation gap, you know, even somebody who is my cousin, who's barely 5 years or something younger to me, I can see that he doesn't even want to be living with his parents and that sort of
thing. Doesn't want to what?
Doesn't even want to live with his parents, you know. So I feel like Kali Bhagavan sort of came to him like that, but I'm not sure, like, how to present these kind of things to him and get
him. Present which kind of things?
Truths from Srimad Bhagavatam, how do we present it?
Better you be the example of the truth, rather than try to force feed them. Let them see in your example such wonderful qualities that they will be inspired to ask, where do you get your knowledge from? How is it that you change your lifestyle? So you demonstrate the wonderful Bhagavatam qualities and they'll be inspired. Some of them. Especially when a crisis comes. So speak through your actions. It's especially important when dealing with family members. Because no matter what you say, often they simply think, oh, it's my son, it's my brother. The bodily conception is so strong. I always give the example. My mother had visited me somewhere at some temple, and she asked me a question about something about Krishna consciousness. And so I gave her the answer. And then, even though I gave her the answer, she couldn't understand. She didn't seem to process it. So then, His Holiness Radha Swami was next to me, and he said the same thing that I said to her. And then she looks at me and says, why didn't you say that? I couldn't believe it. She says, no matter what I say, I'm the baby. I'm her son. That's all she could hear. So ever since that time, I could understand clearly that it can be difficult speaking to your relatives because they simply see you as the body. So you have to be patient. Sometimes they are eager to listen, like we have the Vanna family, family members who, the son, I believe, inspired them all to take shelter of Krishna. So sometimes it happens like that, but often it's just, oh, whatever you say, you're just my son. I always say, my mother's 93 now, and she'll just tell me, oh, I remember when you were a little baby. I said, well, you know, that was only 70 years ago. Doesn't matter, right? Doesn't matter. Just remember, dear, you're always my little baby. So keep that in mind when you're trying to speak to family members, that often they'll just see you as their bodily relation. They don't want anything to jeopardize that or cut that off. But we have many examples of families that did listen to a family member that became a devotee. Like Nanda Mandir's mother. So you have to be expert in knowing when to say something and when not to say something. Anything else? Yeah?
Bhagavatam is true for all ages, then in Satya Yuga, when everybody were Krishna conscious, still then why was it considered a forest of fire?
Till the last sentence?
In Satya Yuga, mm-hmm. when everything were, people were Krishna conscious and they were all, there was a Vedic system going on, why was life still a forest of fire at that time? Because Bhagavatam is true in all ages.
You'll read that, for example, look what happened to Dhruva Maharaj. He was in an advanced yuga, whether Satya or Treta, and he was caught in a painful family situation. His father had many wives, and the wife who gave birth to Dhruva wasn't a favorite of the king. And so when Dhruva tried to climb on the father's lap, Uttanabad Maharaj, tried to, he couldn't do it. And Dhruva was seeing, well, my brothers from the other wives, they're on his lap, why can't I go on the lap? So you know the history. The favorite co-wife, who was not Dhruva's mother, told him, you're just out of luck. You took birth from the wrong woman. Even though your mother is the wife of the king, I am the favorite wife. If you're lucky, here's what you should do. Perform severe austerities for hundreds of births, and then you may get a chance to be born from me. Oh. So, even amongst the demigods on the heavenly planets, there are commotions. Nowhere in the material world, even Satya Yuga or the heavenly planets, will you find complete purity. There's always some discrepancy. Look at Indra. He gets in trouble sometimes. Sometimes the demons can even invade the heavenly planets. If you want complete peace and everything in order, then you go back to Godhead.
And the second question was, when Krishna was on the planet, still at that time, why were they prostitutes?
When Krishna was on the planet, still at that time, why were there prostitutes? I'd have to say it's not something I think about too much. But I do know that Srila Prabhupada said that at that time, even those type of ladies were also devotees. They just had an unfortunate occupation. And that there'll always be men who wander, shall we say, and therefore it's better to have a class of ladies to indulge them. It's better that that happens than the men go and pollute innocent young ladies, which is the case today. So there, as Prabhupada explained it, there are always going to be a few men, even in the best of times, who can control their senses. And better than having them jump from woman to woman, have a class of women who are have that unfortunate occupation. In the 11th canto, you read about Pingala, right? And you read about her transformation. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, you read about Haridas Thakur being attacked by one of those ladies. And instead, he made her into a first-class devotee. There are attacks by demons in every age. It's just that in other yugas, such things are exceptional. They're not the norm. Whereas nowadays, it's the exception if you don't do such things. Such degradation is normal. That's why this, to be a young person these days, to be a teenager specifically, is so difficult compared to decades ago. Because there is so much social pressure on the teenagers. Those of you who have teenagers, you know this. There's so much social pressure to do degraded things because those degraded things are considered normal these days. And if you don't do those degraded things, people think you're crazy. So our parents should appreciate how much pressure their teenage children, their children in their 20s are under. And therefore the parents have to have a strong Krishna conscious home to raise the children in such a strong Krishna conscious atmosphere. So even if the child grows up and rebels for a while, eventually the child comes back to his senses, to her senses. So the parents have to be in the effort, in the campaign for the long range, because it may be that the child deviates for a while. But if the parents have raised the child in bhakti, there's a good chance that later in life the child will revert. Especially when the child marries and has his or her own children. And then they realize, maybe mother and father knew something after all. So sometimes you have to be patient and wait. Still, it's the job, the duty of Krishna conscious parents to do the best they can to raise the child in bhakti, to give the child the best opportunity. But you can't be attached to the outcome. You may not see the child be Krishna conscious in your lifetime. Maybe the child doesn't reignite his or her bhakti until the child's 50 or 60, and you may be gone. But still, you have to do your duty for Krishna's pleasure. Yes.
Thank you, Krishna.
You have to speak loud.
I knew the example you gave about Delhi. Buddhiman and Shaktiman.
You shouldn't ask questions about who is this person.
Why I'm saying, because the important is if the parents are strongly Krishna conscious, they can really make it under me. It's very important. The parents are...
He's saying that if the reason you mentioned the names, because if the parents are Krishna conscious, they can transform their children.
Parents have different visions of what is best for their children in Krishna consciousness and in material life. Just like in the Melbourne Mahaprabhu Mandir community there, parents have different conceptions how to educate the children. Send your children to Middle Park School. No. Homeschooling only. Montessori, Steiner, Catholic school. All the parents I've heard, they have just different conceptions. And how they want their children to be educated, they have different conceptions. My child should only hear Bhagavatam. I want my boy to be Shukadeva Goswami. No. My child should just focus on occupation. I want my child to be Bill Gates than others. I want my child to be both Shukadeva Goswami and Bill Gates.
So as many parents, there are many opinions. So you can't force the parents to adopt a certain response. That's part of the joy of parenting, that you can apply your conceptions and then talk about all the other householders, how they don't know what they're doing. Right? At the dinner table, yes? Yes.
How's the case of people who have been put off by reading Prabhupada's books, like you mentioned that the Bhagavatam presumes a standard, a certain standard of civilization? And
he's asking how to deal with people who think they've been put off by Prabhupada's books because the Bhagavatam is presenting a certain standard of civilization.
Yeah, and like there's a lot of emphasis on Bhagavatam set distribution. So if a new person like reads something like this, and especially a lady, and they're been put off, how do you deal with them?
Because there's emphasis on, he's saying, emphasis on distributing sets of Prabhupada's books, and a new person reads something, goes right to the fifth canto, chapter 14, text 3, during the daytime she's compared to a witch, and at night she's compared to a tigress. Her only business is sucking the blood of her husband both day and night. You explain to them that Prabhupada's books are the most interesting experience, and they're just presenting things that you need to think about more deeply. And you can be anthropological, you can use that big word, be anthropological, be eager to hear about a different culture. It is a different culture, no doubt about it. So that's what I say. I say, well, don't you know how to be anthropological? Reading about different cultures? Oh yes, of course. Yes, yes. If you get mental, they'll also pick up on that. Oh gosh, why did you read that part? Oh no. What do I say? But if they see that you are at peace, they'll think, well, maybe I should consider that there's another way to understand this. So there's no doubt the books are about a different culture. That's true. So you can tell the person. You studied anthropology, you studied in school different cultures, different societies. Just keep an open mind and keep reading. It is a different culture. If you want to be more outspoken, you can say that what people call culture today is actually not culture at all. You encourage them. Just keep on turning the pages. You'll understand how it all fits together. But there's no doubt Srila Prabhupada is very straightforward, and he criticizes every aspect of material life. Every aspect. Therefore, we need places where people can go to get help in reading Prabhupada's books. Prabhupada has created service for you. Well, let me go to Nanda Mandir and Srup Shakti's gathering and I'll read Bhagavad Gita with them so that you can explain to them as they're reading, as you can help them turn the pages. So Prabhupada has created service opportunities for you. Nanda, what does this mean? During the daytime, the one, oh my God. During the day, there are household expenditures and the money earned by the husband at the cost of his blood is taken away. These days, if it's a lady, she'll probably tell you, what is this about the husband earning the money? I make all the money. Right? What does he do? I'm the money maker. So we need cultivation places where people can go and be inspired to turn the pages in the books, especially if they have some difficulty. And because of the association of devotees, the people will be inspired to overlook their mundane conceptions. So again, Prabhupada has created more service opportunities for us. He's so straightforward. He criticizes every aspect of material life. Every aspect. I was just listening to him in 1976 in France. And he would push the point that Indians were happier subjugated under the British. He's using that to make his point that no one knows what they're doing in Kali Yuga. Now, you shouldn't go say that in India. But you see, Prabhupada was 80 years old, you know, and so the etiquette is, you know, that an elderly sadhu, he can say things like that. Even though people are, you know, they won't say anything. Oh, he's a sadhu, elderly. But if you say that, they'll get angry. So Prabhupada is expert at just not giving us any material shelter to stand on. No material foundation. Simply take shelter, Krishna. Take shelter, Krishna. No political arrangements, no economic arrangements. Nothing works. Politicians don't know what they're doing. The scientists don't know what they're doing. The religionists don't know what they're doing. Only Krishna knows what he's doing. Prabhupada is the master of the focus. He knows how to keep everyone focused on Krishna's lotus feet. So that you don't think, you don't have any confidence in anyone or anything material. Just an extraordinarily powerful acharya. A resident of the spiritual world that was amongst us. So the answer to your question again is, we need places where such persons can go and be cultivated. Anything else? Yes?
On the contrary to this verse, Maharaj, that if the wife is very saintly, then to fulfill the mission of life of Karma and
say that again. If the wife is very saintly, what?
She's very saintly and setting good standards of Krishna consciousness in the house.
And setting good standards of Krishna consciousness in the house.
So.
Then what?
Then what the result will be like? What we are hearing in this verse is like.
How many times have I said in this class, this is about material life without Krishna in the center? You forgot already? You keep Krishna in the center and all the attachment can transform into attachment for Krishna's service. The wife is the servant of Krishna, the husband is the servant of Krishna, and their attachment is for serving Krishna together. Didn't I say that in the beginning? They just wanted me to repeat, right? I can understand. These are strong words. The job of the sadhu is to cut. So these strong words make us think. So you are thinking about them, yes?
Yes,
All right. I thank you very much. Hare Krishna.